Well, that's the kind of music you might have heard on East German radio, a really nice march that is railing at the evils of imperialism and capitalism. Punk rock burst into pop culture in the 1970s. Musically, it rebelled against the pompous self-indulgence of progressive rock. Culturally, it rebelled against, well, just about everything. But if you were a punk in the West, your major risks were probably your own drug use. Sid Vicious, anybody? Or maybe a brush with the law from fighting in a club, or the withering scorn of Jack Klugman on the infamous punk rock episode of Quincy. But on the other side of the Iron Curtain, things were much different. In East Germany, just dressing like a punk could get you and maybe other family members hauled in by the feared and hated state security police known as the Stasi. In fact, the East German internal security apparatus showed more aggression toward young punks than it did any other group. That's according to Tim Moore, who's taken a deep look at East German punk culture in his new book, Burning Down the House, Punk Rock, Revolution, and the Fall of the Berlin Wall. House, by the way, is spelled H-A-U-S, so this is not a book about talking heads. Tim Moore is an American who moved to Berlin in the early 90s, where he became a club DJ. He's also an acclaimed writer, editor, and a translator of German literature, as well as collaborating on memoirs by musical stars like Gil Scott-Heron, Duff McKagan of Guns N' Roses, and Paul Stanley of Kiss. He joins us this morning. Hi, Tim.
Morning, John.
Thanks for joining us. I'm glad we finally got you on the line. We had a few harrowing problems there, but things are going well. So let's set the scene for your story. The Eastern Bloc countries under communism placed a lot of emphasis on culture. Symphony orchestras, ballets, theater, certainly film flourished in the Soviet Union because the leaders of those countries believed that, you know, proper cultural expression enforced proper ideology. And it really went to the highest levels. I remember a story where Dmitri Shostakovich was attacked in an article in the Soviet communist newspaper, Pravda, as an enemy of the people. Boy, that sounds familiar. And that editorial was unsigned, but most people believe that Stalin himself wrote it. So that example is from the Soviet Union, but you point out in your book that East Germany was really no different.
Yeah, East Germany, by the 70s, they did have an official rock culture. They decided that that was a more effective means of keeping kids happy. So there were a lot of bands that were kind of imitating things like Deep Purple, like the blues rock and progressive rock of the 70s. But in East Germany, unlike a lot of the places further east, you could pick up Western radio in almost the entire country. And so kids started to hear, especially the Sex Pistols was a spark, started to hear that on British military radio and West German radio. And some of the kids felt like they were articulating something in a way that they wished they themselves could do and had never thought of, and it really kind of intrigued a lot of kids. The first punk in East Berlin was a 15-year-old girl named Major. That was in 1977. And a whole scene grew up around her, basically. She saw a picture of the Pistols and heard the music around the same time, decided to chop her hair into a crazy haircut and do her own version of a punk outfit, which was she took the chain from a toilet plunger and she made some homemade badges. One said, "I'm an enemy of the state," and she put some safety pins across her shoulders as kind of punk rock epaulets, and that's how she got her nickname Major. She went to school the next day and the kid came up and said, "Oh, good morning, Major." So the scene kind of grew up around her. And then it snowballed slowly over the next few years until by the early 80s there were bands making just shockingly anti-government lyrics. And the Stasi at that point decided this was an existential threat, that they were influencing kids to move off the kind of preordained path that the regime wanted to keep them on. And Major was one of the first people made an example of. She was tried and sentenced to a year in prison and then to a five-year banned from entering the city of Berlin, so she couldn't see her friends and family for 5 years after her jail term. She ended up ignoring that, fleeing to Berlin to see her friends, being rearrested, tried again for a year, and shipped off to West Germany, eventually expatriated, just to take care of the problem.
So you moved to East Berlin, or Berlin at that point, in 1990, so just shortly after the fall of the Berlin Wall. How is it that you came to identify the very first punk in East Germany?
Yeah, I moved there in 92. I was just sort of intrigued at the idea of, it seemed like this would be a place where one of these mythical political third ways might be discovered. And even though I was pretty politically naive and basically a typical American, I didn't realize that Oktoberfest in Germany were not the same thing. So I thought I was getting myself into something completely different. I thought I'd get off the airplane, everyone would be in lederhosen, and everyone would be drinking those giant 1 liter beers. And then all along the way, I hoped to see what was going to happen in terms of these former socialist societies dealing with the new system. And then what I found instead of Oktoberfest was a bunch of gray high-rises in the far east of the city where I landed. And it was pretty depressing at first, but then I discovered this whole scene that was happening in the central parts of the city, the former east, where all the derelict buildings and basically an empty city was being reclaimed and formed into this really colorful new world. And it turned out the clubs where I started DJing, well, almost all the first clubs and galleries and bars that sprung up in the east after the fall of the wall were established by former East German punks. And so here I was, just by coincidence, in this world. So I'd grown up fed the same narrative that we all were in the 80s, that the wall had fallen basically because Eastern kids wanted to have McDonald's and Levi's and pop music. And even though I was skeptical about that, I didn't really have any basis for the skepticism until I met these people. And here were the people who'd actually fought the dictatorship. They'd actually been out there and sacrificed their bodies. They'd been subject to basically daily detainment, interrogation, beatings. A lot of them ended up in jail. A lot of the bands, or some of the bands, went to jail for up to 2 years for their lyrics. And so suddenly I realized this was a really important story that had remained invisible. And so even then, before I knew I was going to be a writer, I kind of thought this is a story I wanted to eventually try to tell to people here in the States. And 10 years later, I picked it up.
Tim Moore is our guest this morning, and he's the author of the recently published book, Burning Down the House, Punk Rock Revolution and the Fall of the Berlin Wall. You can join the conversation by calling us at 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. There's a whole lot more to talk about, so lots of interesting characters, and of course the evil Stasi. We'll hear more about them, as well as punk rock and the Berlin Wall, as we continue our conversation with Tim Moore on the other side of a break. Back in 60 seconds here on the Jefferson Exchange. Back on today's edition of the Jefferson Exchange, we're talking with Tim Moore about his new book. It's called Burning Down the House, Punk Rock Revolution and the Fall of the Berlin Wall. And we're talking about how punk rock really played a major role in delegitimizing the East German regime in the 1980s. And this is the kind of music that East Germans typically would have been listening to. Okay, Wir sagen ja was the name of that. Couldn't resist that. Dean Reed, that's another weird story from East Germany we probably don't have time to go into. But the official music was probably pretty much like that, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm, yeah. Yeah, they had some trouble with the beat music, or what we'd call British invasion music, in the 60s, and basically banned it for a time. That was the first real strife over pop music. There were kind of near riots in some of the towns when they banned Beatles-type music. But then it was a whole different thing in the 80s when they decided to crack down on punk, because one of the surprising things to me when I started doing the research was the level of paranoia directed at these punks, because from a Western standpoint, it looks like a bunch of kids with bad haircuts, and you can't understand why it was so threatening. But as I got deeper into it, you saw that they were correct, basically, in the threat that it represented. It went from something aping Western culture to something very quickly, organically Eastern. So where British punks talked about no future because they didn't see a place for themselves in society because of the economic situation, in the East, the punks railed against too much future because they felt their whole lives were set out for them, from the youth organizations to apprenticeships to mandatory service in the army to a place in the planned economy they had no interest in. And they were trying to wrest control of the major decisions in their own lives. And that was something that the Stasi definitely wanted to thwart.
And the German title of your book is actually The Waiting Room of the Future. Tell us about that.
It's a piece of graffiti that the punks used to spray. It's actually the full phrase is "Don't die in the waiting room of the future." And I took it for a call to action. Don't just sit around and hope things will change. You got to get out and do something about it. You got to take control of the situation and change it yourself. Which I think is also one of the reasons this book can be seen as eerily relevant for us at the moment. When I started researching it or started to go back and seriously reach out to the people I wanted to talk to for the book, it was just a fascinating story to me. It was something that was cool, but it wasn't necessarily something that I thought was applicable elsewhere. But now, in the meantime, it took me about 10 years to do the research, we've had the Snowden revelations and seen that we now have, in our own country, mass surveillance at a scale that the Stasi could only have dreamed about. The militarization of the police, the brutal treatment of peaceful protesters here. And so I think that the idea of showing a concrete example of a grassroots youth movement that managed to fundamentally change its society is somehow now important.
Tim Moore is our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join us by phone at 800-838-3760 or by email. jx@jeffnet.org is our email address. Tim, another character who proves to be a major figure in punk in the DDR was a guy whose punk name was Panko, and his background is especially heartbreaking. Tell us about him.
Yeah, like a lot of punks, he had extremely bad relationship with his family as a result of becoming punk. His father started to beat him regularly, and he eventually ran away from home, and he was among the first people to start living in these cracks in society, basically to live the way they wanted to. The punks had to carve out space, and that was both in a figurative or philosophical sense, but also in a physical sense. So they had to find living space, and they would take over unused apartments or even derelict buildings and create these kind of oases where they could live in relative peace without being beaten by the parents, and that also kept them. You had to be somewhat hidden. It was really dangerous to walk down the street looking like a punk. The police would haul you in almost immediately, especially starting in about 82, 83 when the crackdown took place.
So gradually these kids found each other anyway. The dress styles of punk culture are pretty obvious, so I imagine it wasn't hard for people like Major and Panko to find each other, especially in drab East Germany. But you also pointed out that they were often beaten just by ordinary East Germans.
Yeah, that's an interesting aspect of the story. I guess what I concluded from doing the research is that basically the majority of people go along with the system regardless of the system, and that's just as true here as in East Germany. The initial trouble that they had was with ordinary citizens who didn't like people being a squeaky wheel. Conditions in East Germany, we tend to think of the conditions in the Soviet Union when we look at the East Bloc, and East Germany wasn't like that. They had a lot of creature comforts, and there were no food shortages and that kind of thing. So most people were willing to go along with the system, and to an extent even support the system. So there were plenty of people willing to snitch on the punks when it became clear that the police wanted to take care of the problem. And even within the scene, you had, the Stasi were really good at recruiting, especially minors. So they would sort of correctly profile minors, and they were able to convince punk kids that by working with the Stasi, you were actually helping your friends. So a lot of these people are not regarded as evil by their friends now in retrospect, because they realize that they thought they were keeping their friends out of jail or sparing their friends an additional arrest or beating. And then, of course, the Stasi would use the opposite tactic if the first one didn't work, so they could say, you know, it'd be a shame if your parents lost their job or your sister got kicked out of university. So they were really effective at recruiting people to snitch.
And the result was there were informants everywhere.
There really were, yeah. And even under the umbrella of the church, that this is one of the other aspects of the story that sounds almost unbelievable to outsiders. the church had a special status in East Germany, and they couldn't be, basically uniformed security forces couldn't enter churches. And so that gave them, at least in theory, the opportunity to nurture oppositional culture. And some churches, some ministers chose to do this, although the overall structure of the Lutheran Church was not in favor of doing this. And in fact, within the Lutheran Church, it emerged after the war that about 5% of people in the church and clergy were snitches. So even within this ostensibly nurturing community, there were people fighting against the opposition-minded people.
So most of us in the West know the Stasi mainly through films like Das Leben von Anderen and the Lives of Others. It was a really nasty organization. Tell us about its director, Erich Mielke. He shows up in your book quite frequently.
Mielke ended up taking a personal interest in smashing the punk movement. And he was rumored to have learned his craft as an assassin during the Spanish Civil War, so he was definitely someone that was feared. One of the powers that the Stasi had was people didn't really know what the consequences would be when you came in contact with them. And I think one of the game changers for the scene and for the opposition in general was that the punks, they lost their fear of the police. They lost their fear of the Stasi because they interacted with them so much and in some cases spent time in prison and were able to come back out and keep going. So when other opposition-minded people saw that it was possible to resist and survive, that was a game changer. And that led then, in the second half of the 80s, to the protests being more and more visible, to the protests going out into the street, into the public eye, and that allowed protests then to snowball into the mass demonstrations that we saw in 89 that eventually toppled the wall.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating that characteristic of the punks that shook the East German dictatorship so deeply. I mean, in the West, we had people who were considered moral authorities who were all concerned about punk and what it was going to do to our values and everything. But the East Germans were really, really scared of the punks. And I'm wondering if it was the clear message of punk everywhere, which is we just don't give a insert expletive here. And revolutions are often started by people who feel that they just don't have anything more to lose.
Yeah, I think what I said before about losing their fear, I think was even more significant, though, in that they approached it the way you're suggesting. And then when they realized that that was possible, that changed the game, that they could live, that they wouldn't be disappeared, that they wouldn't be absolutely broken, and that they could come back after 18 months in prison, put on the leather jacket, go back out, and keep doing what they were doing.
So let's turn the clock back on the story a little bit. At what point did the punks really get to be on the Stasi's radar screen?
It's pretty quick. Major started, the Stasi file was started on Major only a year after she popped up as a punk in school. And then she was made an example of in early 81. That's when she first went to prison. The bands popped up a little later, and when you hear the lyrics they were singing, you just can't believe they were doing this, the things they were saying. And they were, the major crackdown in the general sense came in mostly in 83, 84, and that's when a lot of people went to prison or were shipped off to army units that specialized in kind of re-educating politically wayward kids. It took a few years before they took it seriously. I think at first they were inclined to think of it as just another teen trend from the West. And one of the problems they had in dealing with the scene is that they never got completely away from that opinion. Even into the late 80s, there are Stasi reports in 88, 89 identifying punk as the top youth problem for the regime, and yet the report goes on to say they think they're being steered by the West. They're being steered either by former Easterners who'd been expatriated or by West Berliners, and I think this undermined their efforts in a lot of ways to take care of the problem, in that they refused to see it as something organically Eastern that was addressing uniquely Eastern conditions.
That's a really fascinating aspect of it, but they did get their initial inspiration, as you mentioned, from the Sex Pistols and other punk bands that were popular in the West at that point. And, obviously radio signals were getting over the Berlin Wall, but there were other routes for punk culture to get into East Berlin, weren't there?
Well, the radio was the primary one. I remember the bass player from Planos, which is one of the early East Berlin bands, telling me that he loved the Ramones because it was the first time he'd ever heard a record where there were no slow songs. So the energy of punk was something that affected people right away. There were there was a surprising amount of cross-border, almost what you call smuggling, especially by the second half of the 80s, where people were able to take things out from the East via contacts in the media or diplomatic corps or whatever, and sell them abroad, like Russian military jackets or cheap Eastern printed sheet music that would then generate money in the West that would be used to buy either records or music equipment that would be smuggled back in to the East. So yeah, there was some more crossover than you might think. And then eventually some West Berlin bands and a lot of bands from East Bloc also came and played illegal shows in churches as well. So the network expanded a lot, although mostly East. The punks tended to be much more focused on the East, and punks in places like Poland, who had made further advances than the ones in East Germany. The punks in Poland were already able to play legally and openly by the second half of the 80s, and obviously political progress in Poland was quicker, too, through Solidarity and eventually free elections prior to the fall of the Berlin Wall.
So was there some kind of relationship between the punk movement in East Germany and the Solidarity movement in Poland?
Yeah, there was a lot of crossover. They worked together a lot. The Polish punks were a big source of inspiration for the East Berlin punks. They threw a giant festival in the second half of the 80s that probably drew up to 5,000 people in East Berlin that was inspired by their travels in Poland. Some of the punks were able to more or less sneak out to Poland and do tours that were not... when they went out of the country, they didn't say they were going on a tour, but they were able to get gear in Poland and go out with some Polish punks and play and just see the scene and see what was happening. And that left them inspired to do bigger scale events at home. I think that had that influence, yeah.
Tim Moore is our guest this morning. He's the author of a new book called Burning Down the House, Punk Rock Revolution and the Fall of the Berlin Wall. If you'd like to join the conversation this morning, you can call us at 800-838-3760, or you can shoot us an email. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Going to take a call now from Sunny Valley. Good morning.
Good morning. Let me get out of the house. What I know from being close to the whole situation, or having been close to the whole situation, is that in East Germany, what was previously the Nazi culture was not eradicated. It was used and relabeled by Stalinism, and that of course affected culture. I mean, it affected music, it affected people's inclinations, people's reflexes, you know, the thinking, the going to authorities, to beating people up who were different. So the xenophobia was part of the culture. So I think that is still something that the country, East Germany especially, is suffering from if you look at the rise of the AfD, the whole right-wing movement.
Thanks for that comment. Tim, I think later in the show we want to talk about sort of contemporary conditions in East Germany, but there are a couple of instances in your book where you're talking about punks being beaten by regular East Germans, and they're saying, you know, if Hitler were still around, he'd make fast work of you guys.
Yeah, there was a lot of ugliness on that front early on. And I think the biggest legal holdover, at least in the context of the punk movement, the biggest legal holdover from the Nazi era was the criminalization of not working. And that was something that was used constantly against punks because they had, because they suffered at the hands of their fellow citizens all the time and because their bosses were usually informing on them, conditions at the workplace were awful for punks. And so they tried to ditch as much as possible, and sometimes they could get doctor's notes for a time. Sometimes they would injure themselves to avoid having to go to work. But if you ditched work enough, then the Stasi could come in and say, well, you're guilty of not working, and we're going to throw you in prison for that. Now, a lot of them would prefer to go to jail for more idealistic reasons. They would prefer to be sent to jail for their lyrics than to go for not working, but it was a very effective tool, the criminality of not working.
And sometimes weren't the punks bosses employed by the Stasi, so that, you know, the boss would fire the punk and then they'd be potentially guilty of not working?
Exactly. So a lot of punks ended up in really awful jobs. There were a lot who worked in graveyards, for instance. And right, this is a place where the church stepped in as well. Some of them would be employed as, say, a janitor in a local church, and that kept them from being criminally unemployed. But, yeah, the bosses, almost any position like that would be integrated into the system. So schools were integrated in the system. There's instances of there was a girl in Weimar who was called into the principal's office one day because she had started to dress punk, and it turned out it wasn't the principal she met with, but it was Stasi officers. So, yeah, I mean, the whole system was tied up with the state security system.
And it wasn't just the Stasi, but also the regular police who were involved.
Yeah, the regular police tended to be more physically brutal, and the Stasi tended to rely more on psychological torture. So, you know, it was a kind of a flip your coin for the various consequences. And dealing with the Stasi did have long-term ramifications for a lot of people. Some of the people I interviewed had basically had to retreat from life since the fall of the wall because the treatment at the hands of the Stasi had affected them so much.
Tim Moore is our guest this morning on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of a new book, Burning Down the House, Punk Rock Revolution and the Fall of the Berlin Wall. A lot more to talk about the punk culture of East Germany and how it brought down the East German regime. And we'll get into that conversation here on the Jefferson Exchange on the other side of this break. More to come. Back with Tim Moore here on the Jefferson Exchange and his book, Burning Down the House, Punk Rock Revolution and the Fall of the Berlin Wall. Couldn't avoid playing some East German punk. That was the band Schleimkeim. And it sounds like they listened to the Ramones once in a while. Tim, tell us about that band.
That band was basically formed in a pig stall in a rural town in the southern part of East Germany. And the head of that band, Otze, he became pretty much the only kind of star in the scene that was basically anti-star. The guy became an absolute legend. He was he drank heavily, he got into a lot of fights, and he was able to stand up for himself and his friends in the little town where they lived, despite the fact that conditions tended to be more brutal in the small towns than in the big ones, because you couldn't just sort of melt away into the center of the city, and because the police tended to know your parents and everything. So it was really tough, but he did have a lot of dealings with the Stasi. He wrote a song that had the lines, "We are the people, we are the power." That song they did in about 85, and that became sort of an anthem for the whole movement, and then those phrases were echoed in the mass demonstrations in 89, and a lot of the first people out on the street for those demonstrations were punks. So it's very possible that those lines came from that song specifically.
So getting back to the first punk in East Germany, Major, as you mentioned earlier, she was at one point arrested and brutalized and sent to prison for quite a while. Was that the incident that really sort of radicalized and politicized the punks?
Yeah, I think a lot of punks got into it for basically what you'd call teenage kicks. It was a thrill. It was daring. It was cool. And then when the hammer came down, that politicized the ones who weren't already political. I mean, some of them were already self-styled kind of anarchist socialists and were more politically aware. But the bulk of them, I think, were politicized through police brutality. Yeah. And then as the generations went on, as younger kids got into the scene, it was the same thing. They would see a punk walking down the street and say, "I can't believe there's people who walk down the street looking like that. I want to do that too." And one of the reasons it was possible to keep getting new members was they weren't necessarily privy to what was happening with the police. Because the scene was never acknowledged in official media, and because it wasn't written about in Western media either, because the punks refused basically to deal with Western media, they were afraid that they would be seen as simple anti-communists or even in favor of unification, which they weren't. So because it was never acknowledged, you could have kids go, wow, that's cool, I want to be a part of that, and not realize that some of the people that they were admiring were being sent off to Stasi prison for 2 years.
So you bring up a really interesting point about the punks in East Germany, which is that they weren't just, oh, we want to join the West. They weren't necessarily, hey, we're punks, but we're pro-capitalism. We really want Coca-Cola and Nike, et cetera. They had very, very different values.
Yeah, the values that you're describing in terms of wanting to be Western and be part of that system, the punks would consider that something that the skinheads, that the right-wingers would be into, and that was one of their fears of being written about in the West, is that they would be lumped in with that. So there's Stasi reports where you read total surprise of a Stasi informant when a Western journalist will turn up at one of these illegal church concerts and start trying to talk to punks, and the punks tell them to piss off, we don't want to talk to you. And the Stasi couldn't understand why this would be the case, because as far as they were concerned, it was a Western phenomenon, and they were being manipulated by the West. But here they were refusing to even talk to Westerners. And, yeah, that was because I think if there's any wistfulness of punks for this era, it's not for the Stalinism, it's for the moment just after the wall fell, when it looked like there might be a possibility to establish an independent country based on a different set of more idealistic version of socialism. And that is a missed opportunity. I think people really wish, all the opposition-minded people were happy to have the wall gone, but almost none of them wanted to join West Germany.
Tim Moore is our guest this morning, the author of Burning Down the House, Punk Rock Revolution, and the Fall of the Berlin Wall. If you'd like to join the conversation, ask a question, make a comment, you can call us at 800-838-3760 or send us an email. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We mentioned the skinheads. Wolfgang, who called a little bit earlier, talked about the influence of Nazi ideology continuing in the East. What was the relationship between the punks and the skinheads?
Enemies. They fought in the streets, and that continued after the fall of the wall. What happened on November 9th, 1989, the night the wall fell, one of these bands was playing a gig, and during their set, the crowd started going nuts, and they thought, wow, gee, either we're playing great, or they couldn't basically figure out what was happening. They finished the set, come off the stage, they're told the wall's fallen. They break up the band that night. So it was clear to the scene that their message and their music was not going to be relevant to the next task. And so they basically poured that kind of do-it-yourself energy and their ethos of controlling their environment into other avenues, primarily the nightlife scene. What we consider so cool about Berlin today is this incredible nightlife scene, and that really reflects the ethos of East German punks. But as they set up that system, where they were creating these basically squatted buildings where they could enact their idealized vision of how they wanted to live, they were constantly being attacked by skinheads in the early 90s. So they developed a sense of collective defense, basically, their walkie-talkies, so they could rally basically almost paramilitary defensive forces in a matter of minutes if any of the houses were attacked.
And so culturally, what kind of music, you know, if you go back to East Germany, what kind of music were the skinheads listening to? Was it more like metal music? Or?
No, I mean, a lot of them, especially the first generation, did come out of the punk scene, just the same as it was in the UK. But they just were at complete odds politically speaking. And to a certain extent, through the middle of the 80s, they would still come to the punk concerts and the churches, and the friction just grew until it was no longer tenable, and the punks basically kicked them out of all their kind of main sanctuaries.
So in the weeks and months leading up to the fall of the Berlin Wall, can you describe what kind of activities the punks were involved in then, and at what point that energy that they had that was opposing the regime kind of spread out farther into the general public?
Yeah, well, obviously no one group can foment a revolution. But the punks were the most sort of radical members of all these oppositional groups, and there were certain groups that were almost punk organizations. One of the most prominent ones was it's called the Church from Below, and that was something that the Stasi considered the biggest threat in the late 80s, especially towards the last 2-3 years of the regime. And what they were able to do was go out into the street. They would take the protests off of church grounds and into the street because, like I said, they knew what this entailed. They knew they would be arrested. They knew they might get beaten. They knew they might be detained for a certain amount of time, but they knew they could survive it. And then there was a boomerang effect as those people were beaten in public. I think that made people recoil, made ordinary citizens who weren't probably not often confronted with actual state-sanctioned violence. When they saw that, that caused them to recoil, and I think more and more people thought, well, you know what, I don't really agree with what's going around here also, so I'm going to join one of these protests. And it was a slow process. From probably about 87 on, they started doing the protests outside of the church in Leipzig. That became the most famous of the mass protests in 89. And they were able to just win over ordinary citizens to their cause slowly.
Now, the only East German official we've mentioned in this hour was the Stasi chief, Erich Mielke. The other name from that era that I think some Americans would remember was the head of East Germany, Erich Honecker. He was replaced shortly before the Berlin Wall fell with a guy named Egon Krenz. But was Honecker himself scared of the punks?
Honecker took a personal interest in a few aspects of the crackdown. He was really animated against some of the peace activism in the mid-80s, and that was a mix of punks and sort of older generation, more like hippies. And Honecker then also had to be personally involved in, there was a trial of some skinheads in the late 80s where they basically ignored despite the fact that witnesses had said that they were skins and identified themselves as right-wingers and neo-Nazis, that had been sort of swept under the carpet, and they'd been given a light sentence for hooliganism or vandalism or something. And there was a big outcry both among Eastern activists and then in the West, because some of the Eastern groups did have connections to Western media and they got that story out into the West. So Honecker had to become personally involved in increasing the sentence of the skinheads.
So, Tim Moore, have you followed the punks since reunification? I mean, the wall fell 30 years ago, so they're in probably their 40s and 50s now. But once reunification happened, they found themselves in a new culture where, at least in the West, especially the UK and America, you know, punk was at best a subculture and, you know, at worst, looking at it from a punk perspective, a lifestyle choice. Nobody would want to undergo the treatment that the people in your book endured from the Stasi and the police, but still the fact that they were treated that badly meant that the East German state really feared them. I mean, they had some kind of power. That meant something. But in the West, you know, they kind of were just punks. Is that right?
Yeah, like you said, they realized really quickly that both their music and their message was going to have to change, and they poured that energy into other avenues. There's still people involved in the nightlife scene from the original East German punk gangs, and some people, there's a guy who makes film music, for instance. But a lot of them are living much more conventional lives now, although there's also the subset of people who have struggled to deal with life because of the psychological wounds inflicted by the Stasi.
And, you know, in West Germany now, it seems like, the former West Germany, I should say, it seems like there's this kind of weird sort of ironic stance toward the former DDR. I mean, I've seen books on East German style and East German design, and there's this kind of like, you know, it's sort of a weird nostalgia. Has that had any effect on the punks?
Well, you hear the word Ostalgie used sometimes, which is meant to mean something like Eastern nostalgia. And I think the main source of that nostalgia is sort of the material culture. So you and I can go home to the town where we grew up at the holidays and still smell the dishwashing liquid that our parents used, or the laundry detergent and those type of things. Those other senses of home that aren't necessarily physical. And East Germans will never experience that. All the products that they grew up with don't exist anymore. So I think there's a kind of, I think that's a legitimate nostalgia for that, those other senses of home beyond the physical. I'm sympathetic to that. I don't think there's a political nostalgia. I do not think that there's a lot of neo-Stalinists who came out of this scene or any other scene. So I think you have to distinguish those two things, and I think people are quick to confuse them here in the States. I think people tend to think, oh, they're pining for the dictatorship, and I don't think that's the case.
Well, and there are probably very few Trabants left running, too.
They're kind of fun cars to drive.
I bet they're kind of scary. Tim Moore is our guest this morning. Tim, very quickly before we leave, we talked about the punks having blended into the new Berlin night culture, club culture, et cetera. Are there still some punk bands from the days of East Germany that are touring through Europe?
In recent years, they've finally been able to issue some of their music because they were banned from all the state media offices. They couldn't record. They couldn't distribute records or tapes. They couldn't get on the radio, none of that stuff. And they would just, once in a while, they were able to make tapes on handheld cassette recorders in basements. And those things would circulate in the 80s. That was there was a fairly significant trade in these homemade tapes. But now, in recent years, they've finally been able to issue some of that stuff in vinyl. So it's cool to see the bands able to get together, do a concert again, and have their vinyl available for people. There's some really cool music. You don't have to be a German speaker to hear the sort of revolutionary passion of those bands. They really, it's a case where they really harness the kind of what we think of as the revolutionary power of rock and roll.
And I imagine they have a bit of a following as well.
Yeah, and I think it gets, like I said, more and more relevant each day, I'm afraid, because they more or less created a handbook for resisting authoritarianism, and that's a handbook that turns out to be useful and elsewhere and in other times.
Tim Moore has been our guest today. Thank you, Tim, for joining us here on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the author of Burning Down the House, Punk Rock Revolution, and The Fall of the Berlin Wall. Thanks again.
Thanks, John.